Hello, friends, and welcome to Through These Doors, a Fame Recording Studios podcast. I'm your host, Rodney Hall, with Fame Recording Studios, where it all started in Muscle Shoals. And together, we'll be digging deep into the history of Fame Recording Studios and the Muscle Shoals sound, with the musicians, engineers, producers, and music insiders that have turned this small town into a music landmark known around the world. Welcome. Let's get it on. All right. Welcome to this week's version of Through These Doors podcast. Today, we are lucky to have legendary record producer, songwriter, Keith Stegall with us from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome, Keith.
Rodney, how are you?
I'm good, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. So Keith is a legendary record producer, songwriter, and artist, winning multiple CMA, ACM, and Grammy Awards. His songs have been recorded by Dr. Hook, Al Jarreau, Al Jackson, Sammy Kershaw, and 98 Degrees, just to name a few. Keith has produced classic records on Randy Travis, Zac Brown Band, George Jones, and has over 50 million records sold on Alan Jackson with 35 number one singles. Overall, as a producer, he has over 55 number one hits as a producer and or songwriter. 40 million airplays as a songwriter, produced over 70 million records sold, blah, blah, blah. And with all this said, Keith is a great guy and he's a good friend. We're so glad to have him today. He's taking the time out of his day to talk with us. And so welcome, Keith. You are episode number two. So thank you.
Number two.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
So yeah, tell the people a little bit about your introduction into music and how you got started back in the day.
Back in the Stone Age. I think my first brush with music was because of my father, like you. I think I must have been 3 or 4, and my dad bought a tape recorder. It was a 3M tape recorder, a quarter-inch tape recorder.
Right.
And I have these memories of him sitting in the living room with his guitar and this little square microphone and singing into this microphone and watching this machine with these wheels turn. And then he would stop it and back it up and he would be singing on that tape coming out of that machine. So I think at a very, very early age, I was fascinated by that and was moved by it. And then my father, being a musician, taught me the guitar first. Piano. Taught me the piano first when I was like 4 or 5. And then he taught me guitar when I was 9 and 10. And then I just experimented learning to play the drums and learning to play the bass and learning to play the saxophone. And I just was kind of just into music, period, from a very early age.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy how technology's changed, hadn't it, from that time. I know my dad would talk about the early days when they were recording his first hits. Was on a machine that couldn't fade. They didn't have a fader. They just had to turn the equipment off and the tubes would slowly die down and it would fade out.
Yeah, I actually had an uncle who had a recording studio in Texas, and actually that's where I first got serious experience in a recording studio. And he had a one track, was his first machine, and everything was cut direct to mono, of course.
Right.
And he got a stereo machine, which was they used it differently than we use stereo. They would use both tracks and mix it into mono. Then he got a 3-track, and then he built his own 4-track, and that was huge at that time. That would have been the early 60s. So, but I was taken by the studio as well. I would go to my uncle's house and spend, you know, while the grown-ups were talking in the kitchen, I'd be in that recording studio running around and playing all the instruments or sitting in the control room and listening to a playback. The first time I ever heard the music coming through that big speaker, it was like, oh my God, this is all I ever want to do is sit and listen to music.
Yeah, yeah, it was magic. It's like, wow, they can record onto that and then listen back. Wow. Crazy. So you were an artist in your younger days, and you had a couple solo albums, one on Mercury, one on Columbia. And how did those come about?
I never wanted to chase getting a record deal, but they kept offering to me when I would send demos of things that I was writing.
So you were publishing, and did you already have a publishing deal?
My first publishing deal was with a company called April Blackwood, which was under the CBS banner. But I was just trying to learn to write songs. That's really all I wanted. And I would go in and demo the songs. And actually, on my first demo session was Sexy Eyes, the tune that Dr. Hook recorded. There were three or four other tracks on there, and we sent them to Capitol Records. And Lynn Schultz, who was running Capitol in Nashville, called me and said, "Do you want a record deal?" And I thought, well, yeah, why not? I wasn't looking for one, but if you're going to give me one, I'll take it. But I quickly found out that getting a record deal is just the beginning of your problems. So I think in the course of my career, I've had three record deals. So that equates to three strikes, you're out.
So how did you get from that into production?
Well, actually, I'd always kind of been producing. Like when I would go to my uncle's studio, I would kind of take charge. I didn't know that was being a record producer. So when I got to town, I kind of figured out what a record producer was. And then when we were doing the demos, I just would basically be the coach, you know, and go, let's do a fill here. Let's do this. Let's change the intro. Let's change the outro, you know, and just all the aspects of getting the track together. And so I started having people approach me that had heard my demos and go, "Who produced your demo?" And I'd say, well, I did. And they would say, "Well, would you be interested in maybe producing some of my demos?" And so that's really how I got started. That's how it was with Randy. And that's specifically how it was with Alan. And Alan was relentless. I kept backing up going, "Man, you know, I'm not a great record producer. You need it." He goes, "No, you're going to do this." And so I finally gave in. And so my production career, the success I've had, really Alan Jackson is responsible for that, because he just wouldn't leave me alone. He wanted me to produce his records. And to this day, I'm thinking, "Man, were you a fool or what? You could have missed one of the biggest opportunities in your life." But yeah, I'm super grateful to that and for his belief and support in my abilities, what little they are.
Yeah, you 35 number one records and 50 million records later, I guess he's probably sorry. I think you did okay. So you, at one point you met a guy named Randy Ray and started working with him. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, actually, Randy Ray Trawick.
Yeah.
And he was playing at the Nashville Palace and working in the kitchen. And when he would get off working in the kitchen, he would go up on the stage and he would sing. And this incredible voice would come out of this young man. And it was Randy Travis. Of course, his name was changed to Travis when they signed him to Warner's. But that was, so I ended up doing a live record on him, and that was the beginning of that relationship. And then he got signed to Warner's, and I co-produced part of the record with Kyle Lenning, and that was the Storms of Life record.
Right. And tell us, tell me a little bit about how that ended.
Well, what's interesting is Kyle Lenning, who is the producer of note for Randy Travis at the time, was my record producer. And I told Kyle about Randy, and I said, "Kyle, I'm on the road all the time, and I feel guilty because I can't be on site to be a producer." And I said, "You're really a producer, and I'm an artist." And I said, "I just feel like I need to be on the road, you know, supporting my artistry career." So I walked away from that, and that was right before on the other hand, came out for the second time and blew up the charts. So I, you know, I had a lot of introspective thoughts and conversations with myself going, what have you done? What have you done? You had a huge opportunity with Randy and you walked away from it. And so what the angel on my shoulder told the devil on my other shoulder, the next time something good comes along, you're going to jump at it and stay with it. And that next thing that came along was Alan Jackson.
Yeah, you're probably saying that to yourself as the royalty checks from Randy came in, right?
Exactly. That, well, yeah, because when I had just gotten back from off the road and my bus was had already broken down again, I was looking at another $10,000 bill on my bus, and as I was walking back to the house, I passed the mailbox and there was an envelope in there, and I pulled it out. It was from Warner's Records, and it was for $13,000. I went, holy cow, I'm doing the wrong thing. So that was a big moment of truth for me.
Yeah, I'm sure. So we got Jeff Taylor has asked a question online. Do you know Dean Dillon?
Oh, of course I know Dino.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've known Dino when he was Dean Rutherford.
Right.
But yeah, he got to town about a year before me.
Yeah. So y'all been friends a while.
And obviously it didn't work out for him. So
yeah, he's a legendary writer. He's written hundreds of hit records. So at what point did you become aware of Muscle Shoals?
Gosh, I was aware of Muscle Shoals before I ever got to Nashville. And I think it was primarily because of the association with Aretha. And then I was a huge fan of the records that were, I can remember being 16 years old and hearing Patches and going, oh, I got to go buy that. That's when you could go buy 45s. But the music that was coming out of Muscle Shoals was having, you know, had a profound effect on me. And then once again, when I bought my first Macanelli record and I flipped it over, there it was again. And I went, golly, this place has something in the water and it's magical. So it's very, very special to me. And I think the music for me affected me greatly in the especially on the R&B side of things when I try to write things that are in that field in that genre.
Right.
I'm affected by what I had heard years ago coming out of Muscle Shoals.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, growing up around R&B music, I never was a huge country fan, but when Randy Travis came out, and On the Other Hand specifically, when I heard that record, I was like, man, I gotta check this out. And that Storms of Life album completely turned me into a country music fan. So
it was a great record.
Reciprocating.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so you wrote a record that was recorded in Muscle Shoals at Muscle Shoals Sound over at Jackson Highway called Sexy Eyes, which Dr. Hook cut. How'd you get that cut? Did you just pitch it to someone?
Well, that was Lynn Schultz again at Capitol, who was good friends with Ron Hafkind, and he played it for Ron, and so Ron jumped on it. And it was really my first major record as a writer. So I had no idea what that meant, you know. And after Ron had mixed it, he called me over to his office. And I was just a green kid. I think I was like 25 years old. And he said, do you have any idea how big this record's going to be? And I went, no. He goes, it's going to be huge. And I went, what do you mean huge? He goes, Europe, not just America, but Europe. And then of course, when it came out, I started watching multiple foreign charts and watching that happen, which I had no idea. You know, I was greener than government ink. I didn't know anything. So it was a nice way to come into the music business.
Yeah, that was a huge record. They were on fire at that time. They just had Sharing the Night Together. And When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman. Yep. All that stuff. So next up, you had a big hit on Al Jarreau. How did you beat Al? was about 1981, right?
Well, yeah. I think it would have been 80 or 81. That song we sent, excuse me, to a guy named Patrick Rains, who managed a band called the Larson Featon Band, which you probably don't remember, but he also managed Al Jarreau. And we sent the cassette. Back in those days, you send a cassette, and somehow that cassette landed in Al's box instead of the Larson Featon Band's box. And so the story gets better from there. So the night before they're recording, Jake Radin is going through songs, and they get down to one cassette left in the bottom of the box, and Jake Radin goes, "If that's not our single, we're not going to record tomorrow." And it was "We're in This Love Together." So they pulled it out and popped it in, and there it was.
Yeah, classic. That's probably his biggest record, right?
Yeah, maybe. I think he had a couple other, I think that record went to 13 or 12 or something like that on the pop charts. I think he had another one, maybe Moonlight. Oh, the Moonlighting Theme did pretty well.
Oh, so. Yeah.
Forgot about that. It was a big record for him.
Yes. So you've had a long career with Alan Jackson. And that started in the mid 80s, somewhere in there, early 80s. And
that's cool.
He wanted you to produce him. He had it in his head that you were the guy, huh? Did he have anything going at that time? Yeah.
No, he had a band, and he was playing, he's playing truck stops and dives and anything he could play. And he was writing for Glenn Campbell. And a guy named Marty Gamblin, who's a good friend of mine, was running that company for Glenn. And so a bunch of us who didn't really have anything better to do would hang out at Marty's office every afternoon. And Alan, of course, would be in there because Marty was managing Alan, trying to get him a record deal. And so I would bring my demos in and play them. And Alan would listen to my demos and he'd go, "How'd you get that sound on that vocal? How'd you do this? How'd you do that?" And so that's where the relationship started. And finally, Marty says, "Want you to go in and do some demos on Alan to see if we can get a record deal." And so that was actually the very beginning of that. And we recorded, I think, maybe five things. But in those five things, there was Chasing That Neon Rainbow and Wanted, and a couple other things I can't recall right now, but that was the piece right before he got the record deal. Then he got the record deal and the rest is history.
Yeah. So 35 number ones. So, that doesn't happen very often for an artist and producer start working together and to work together their entire career. Matter of fact, I can't think of many instances at all where that's been the case, but that's a huge testament to y'all's partnership for sure. And the success is obviously there. It takes a special relationship for that to continue.
Yeah. I think we're friends and that helps, that there's a deep friendship there. We're actually in the middle of the next record right now. So I was working with him today doing vocals. So it's working with him is like coming home. It's just a very comfortable, relaxed way to do things.
Right. Right. I'm going to play a little bit of some of your music with Alan here, if I can get it to come up on my screen here. Let's see. This is the first hit you guys had together here in the real world. You hear that?
Yeah.
Cowboys don't cry.
So he's written pretty much everything, most everything he's had as a hit, hasn't he? Except for just a handful.
Well, there's a couple of good ones in there, like Don Country with Bob McPhil. 5 o'clock somewhere, he did try. I don't think probably just piss off a songwriter by not remembering some other things that he's had that were hits by other writers. But I would say probably 80% of the hits have come from things he's written. Because he's such a good writer.
Yeah.
And a great storyteller.
Absolutely. Midnight Montgomery is one of my favorites. Great record. So who, do you use a base group of musicians on his records, or is it usually the same guys, or is it different every album, or how do you go about
it? There's been a core that we've used through the years, and kind of changed it up at different times, but actually this next record we're making, we went back to the original core, which is Brent Mason, Eddie Bear, Stuart Duncan, Glenn War, Paul Franklin, Gary Prim. So that's pretty much the standard Alan Jackson rhythm section, except with the exception of Pig Robbins, and Pig played on a bunch of the early stuff too. But I'm a firm believer in that the section that you have dictates the brand, the way it's going to continue with the sound over a period of years. So I've kind of stuck to that formula and it worked for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, obviously. So, at some point you did an album with George Jones. Tell us about that. That had to be an interesting session. He was later in his career and hadn't had a hit in a few years from what I remember. You did the Cold Hard Truth album, which had Choices on it, which is just an amazing song.
Yes, that record is pretty interesting because I made two records at once while we were doing that. In the morning, I was tracking George for the Cold Hard Truth, and in the evening, we were tracking Alan Jackson's Under the Influence album. And they both had the same rhythm section, so we just kind of blocked out the day. The experience of working with George Jones was like, I can't even describe it. The emotion, the energy, the electricity, it was all there because of just simply his greatness as an artist. So it was a high point for me to get to work with him. And unfortunately, we happened to be in the middle of the record when he had this car wreck that put him in the hospital. So I had to kind of halfway finish this record without his presence, which was difficult because we had to use a lot of stuff that was not vocals that were overdubbed. They were all live from off the floor when we actually tracked the record. So it was pretty time-consuming.
Oh.
But it was a high point for me. And the first time I heard his voice come through the speakers, it was tickling and emotional and moving. That's all I know to say about it.
Yeah, I hear you. I kind of felt that way with Michael McDonald when he did that record.
Yeah.
Do you have any great classic George Jones stories that happened during the sessions that you can share?
he was just always, you know, he was telling old jokes constantly, and he actually made the sessions fun just because he was a rascal, you know.
Right.
And I think one moment I remember, I sat down at the piano and was working up a song that I had written for him. And he sat down beside the piano, or sat down beside me at the piano, and he put his arm around me and he goes, "Sing it to me, baby." And so I was sitting there singing for George Jones, and it was.
Yeah, I'm sure. Just crazy. So you did the first, I guess it was Zac Brown's first album, Had he done any albums before you started working with him?
Yeah, he had put some stuff out himself. So there were different versions of Chicken Fried that had been out for a while, and some other tracks that we did. But he didn't back up to that. He just said, here's what I want to record, and that was the record that became the Foundation album, which was the first record that I did with him, and which had Chicken Fried and Free and Toes in the Water, a bunch of great songs.
Yeah, that was a huge album. Huge album. So you did, how many albums did you do with Zach?
Three.
Great. And you were actually running the label, right, that he was on? Tell us that story.
Well, that's, I don't want to go that far. We had a partnership with him. And then Atlantic Records joined the partnership.
Right. Right. There are some great records, I'll tell you that.
He's a great artist. That band is a great band.
Yeah, so they played on all the records, huh? Was it Session?
Oh, yeah. That was what was so much fun about it. It took me out of the environment of having a crew and using the band. And it was tougher, and it took us longer, but the album reflected these great players in this band. So it was my first brush with doing a band. So now I've become much more adept at recording a band who's not a bunch of session players, but just great musicians. And it's very rewarding.
Very cool, very cool. So a few years ago, Keith and I started having some conversations about a project I'd started working on called, it was just the Muscle Shoals project at the time. We didn't really even have a name. And so we got together, and let's hear your perspective on it, Keith, how the Muscle Shoals record came together, and I'm tired of telling it.
Well, I think the music was the most fun part. The pain in the ass part was the releases and the sign-offs and the approvals and all of that stuff. But the music, there were moments in the making of that record that were hugely inspiring. And you mentioned the Michael McDonald piece that day is burned into my brain when we did that. Also Demi, singing the Aretha track is another one. And then of course, for me, the whole process started with the record that had Chris Stapleton and Willie, and Jamie Johnson and Leanne Womack. That's where for me, and I think you sent me that, it's where I got engaged, and I was in after that. I was like, what do we got to do to make this happen? Be an ambassador
to England. Yeah. And then it went from there, and we got started getting artists. We got Tom Johnston and Delbert McClinton to do a track, and then you may be the heavy Demi Lovato did a track, Grace Potter. It was a fun record. It was a fun record to do, but like you say, the rest of it was was a little brutal at time. We'll play a couple of these things that we did. This one. This is Grace Potter. She did Etta James' classic record, I'd Rather Go Blind, and this went number one on the Americana charts. And so Keith and I went in and cut the tracks with Muscle Shoals guys, Clayton Ivey, and I can't remember exactly who all was on it. But then we sent it to Grace's husband, Eric Valentine, who is a great producer, musician, and he finished it. He made us look great. it's a really good record, but I'm gonna play a little bit of that for him. Let him check it out. Something deep down in my soul said cry, girl. When I saw you and that girl walking around. Ooh. And I would rather go blind.
to see you walk away from me, child. You see, I love you so much, I don't want to watch you leave me, darling. And most of all, I just don't want to be free now. I was just sitting here thinking of your kiss and your warm embrace. When the reflection in the glass that I held to my lips.
Yeah, that's a great record. And ironically, that was out the same time as Tennessee Whiskey was, and which Tennessee Whiskey is the same song with different words, same melody.
So it's true.
Yeah. So, you know, this is, I guess this is a little bit of a weird question coming from me, but, you know, I don't have the perspective of working at Fame and never working anywhere or working in a lot of other studios. I've always worked at Fame and it's been 99%. So what's your experiences at Fame like compared to other studios you've worked in?
Well, I'll use this term again that I used earlier about making records with Alan. It feels like coming home. The intense environment that sometimes surrounds the recording session, and I've felt that a lot of times when I was doing a record in Nashville, there's so much pressure to perform, to excel, to create. It's not that way in Muscle Shoals. In Muscle Shoals, there's such a brother and sisterhood of people that are extremely talented coming together in a room, and they know before the day is over or they walk out of that room, something great is going to happen. And it's not planned, and it's all feel. And that's really all music is. It's all feel. It's all soul. And I think sometimes there are people in the music business that don't understand what that even means. But it's you hear it, and even in this record, you hear it in Michael McDonald, you hear it in Demi, you hear it in Grace, and you hear it in great artists. Even in Nashville, you hear it in Alan Jackson, you hear it in Zach Brown, the passion part of it, and you can't manufacture that. It just happens, and that's what Muscle Shoals does, and that's what they've always done.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's more laid back environment, and we try to keep it, you know, very, very, very much like that most of the time, laid back and just, hey, let's do it. It's music. Let's have fun with it. So what's your perspective on working in different genres? Is it a different production style? Is it a different, do you approach it differently?
Well, I think you almost have to. I mean, the box that works for Alan Jackson, and I hate to even put it in terms of a box, but you kind of know how you have to address that, or I do. I know what kind of songs that are going to make the project soar. I know that he's going to come to the project with a certain amount of things that he's written that are going to be great. So that's one way of doing things. When it comes to a band like that, you kind of have to put on another hat, realize that it's going to take you a longer time to get this, but it's going to be really something incredible when you get through with it. As far as the programming and constructing tracks with Logic or Pro Tools, I understand that animal too, and I'm a little more technically challenged when it comes to that, but that's a whole different animal of how you have to approach making music. So I think my most favorite way of making music is with a great artist and a great song and a great rhythm section.
Yeah, absolutely. So a few other artists you've worked with, John Fogerty, did you some things with him and Alan Wright? What was that like? Such a legendary guy, man. Yeah. Creedence Clearwater Revival.
And sometimes I get a little bit taken aback when I'm working in an environment with people like that. They walk into the room and you feel like saying, you're supposed to be on that album cover. You're not supposed to be walking into the room, you know, and it's a very, it's very captivating to be in the presence of people like this that you've admired and listened to their records and been inspired by. But he was great to work with, absolutely a sweetheart. And it was that voice, you know, that we call CCR came out. It was like, oh my, there that is.
Yeah.
So it was a treat working with him.
Yeah, absolutely. What a singer. Incredible. So you're working on a new Alan Jackson record. Where are you in that process? Have you got things recorded? And I think Jeremiah Tucker here wants to know if you're looking for songs.
We are through with that process. We've just we just finished tracking. I think we've tracked about probably 15 to 20 songs. So we're in the singing process right now of him coming in and singing a couple of tracks each day and just kind of moving through getting the final vocals done at this point.
Right. Very cool. Very cool. Hey, back to Al Jarreau. How did you meet Al? You were telling me this story earlier. No, I thought it was.
I met him after the song was a hit. I actually met him at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. I went to the show because he launched his tour off the success of that single.
Right.
So that was when I met him. He was such an exceptionally kind and generous and sweet man, and extremely talented too.
Yeah. So at one point you ran Mercury Records?
Yes.
Is that right? So what was, yeah. How was your experience as a record label executive? Was that intense, fun, terrifying?
Well, I felt like it was part of an education, the last piece of an education I needed to round out my education in the music business. There were parts about it that I absolutely loved because I was able to sign people that I thought were talented and needed to be heard. That was exciting. The business side and the politics sucked. So, yeah. You know, I'm a better soldier out here on the street and have had better luck on the street than within the confines of a record label.
So you started Dreamline. When was that?
4 years ago.
And tell us a little bit about that company and what you got going there.
It's a production maybe publishing / production company. We've got, I think, 4 or 5 writers and several artists in that pile. So it's, you know, we just try to create a place for people who are creative to come hang out and write songs. Because the song is the key to this whole thing. So fostering that, encouraging that, funding that is part of this gig. So we're just a safe house for creative people.
Right. So you've got, I know some great writers, Brian Mayer, you've got, James LeBlanc, who we share publishing on, and Daniel Smalley, right? He's an artist on Big Machine.
That's right.
That you're working with, that you guys need to keep your ears out for. He's a talented young guy. Any other new artists you got in the wings?
Kevin Mack.
Yeah.
He's part of our family. The Outlaw Apostles, which are, you know well, an incredibly great band from Muscle Shoals.
Yep.
A part of our family. And I'm probably forgetting somebody that's obvious, but my daughter. My daughter actually writes for the company.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're we're a nut house that's shepherded by a den mother that we call Jenny Johnson. So
yep, it's Jenny Wells, it's great. She's on the streets for you. She's a great girl, and she does a great job for you. And love Jenny. She was right there with us on the Muscle Shoals record all the way through. It was a labor of love for all of us. So are there any, my dad always had a group of writers that he really always looked to when he was doing a record. Who's some of your favorite writers that are breaking through the scene now in Nashville or that have been there?
Oh man. Gosh, I hate to even start mentioning names because some of them won't pitch me any songs anymore when I need them. But I mean, obviously, I was a huge fan of Chris Stapleton before he ever had any recognition as an artist. His songwriting was what captivated me, and obviously, people like him, Roger Murra, who's been a long time friend of mine, is just an incredible writer still. Who else? James LeBlanc. Oh my God, what a great writer.
Yep.
So that's a handful of people, and I'm sure that there's a lot more, but at the moment it's hard to come off the top of my head.
Yep. Alan Jackson's probably one, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
We're living in a weird time now with COVID. You know, we'd probably be doing this face to face if not for COVID-19 and all that's going on there. How has that changed your business and the atmosphere in Nashville music scene?
Well, it's changed it dramatically. Of course, because I think of the shutdown of live performances has impacted the revenue for artists across the board. So there's a sense of, there's a sense of caution. There's a sense of what's going to happen. There's that whole thing of trying to keep bands together, trying to figure out how to pay bills when that part of the industry is pretty much shut itself down. So probably about the only healing aspect that we have is actually still recording music, because you can, for a minute, you could forget about the economics and just get lost in the process of making great music. And eventually this will be over. So I think we all pray for that and hope for that and live for that.
Yeah. Live musicians, especially guys that make their living playing live, whether it's in a local bar or in arenas, these guys were the first to be shut down, and they'll be the last to come back most likely. I mean, I'm hearing some guys saying that, it may be 2022 before they hit the road again. And that's just, it's incredibly sad. And just all you fans out there, if you'll keep that in mind and watch these guys live streams, and if you're a fan of somebody, follow them and buy their music and help any way you can, because it's a really, really tough time for everyone in this business. Well, Keith, we want to thank you for coming in today and talking to us. It's always a pleasure to see you. We've spent a lot of time together over the last few years, and just it's been a pleasure getting to know you. And
I'm here, Rod.
Keep up the great work, and everybody keep your eyes out, because for what Keith's doing and what Dreamline's doing, because they make some great music and got some really talented guys there, and just it's just quality people and quality music, and that's about the best thing I know of these days.
Absolutely.
We want to ask everybody to go to our website and sign up for our newsletter at famestudios.com. We have a backstage area there where we'll be posting lots of behind the scenes music, pictures, and video. We have every month we have a featured artist. Last month was legendary songwriter producer Walt Aldridge, who was with Fame for 20 years and had about 56 top 10 records and just several songs of the year, and just a legendary musician, songwriter, producer for us. This month it'll be Mickey Buckins, who was been with us for years, back to the early days. He was a leader of the Fame gang and wrote songs that have been recorded by Joss Stone, the Osmonds, Clarence Carter, just multiple people. And just he's a mainstay in the Muscle Shoals music industry. We'll also be next week on Through These Doors, we're going to have David Shaw from the Revivalist, New Orleans band that's recorded several things at Fame. And so we'll have him next Friday, I believe, the 9th at 6 o'clock. So join us back here then. And until then, we will see you later. Have a good weekend.
Ciao.